So just in full disclosure, that was me. I was the commander, and I was trying to...
You were trying to
He was the first Aggie to fly in space, so I had to mess with him.
Right.
I just had to.
But now, what my friend here didn't know is that Aggie Mike had informed the entire Aggie world that the Aggie War Hymn was going to be played this morning. My boss, two levels up, my administrative boss, because the flight director is king, but... you know, in a certain kingdom, was the ultimate Aggie flight director. And he had imported the entire Aggie Glee Club from Texas, from College Station, put them on buses and brought them into the viewing room behind us, waiting to hear the Aggie War Hymn. I was in a completely no-win situation. I mean, I was going to be in touch with my boss. I was going to be in touch with the crew, which you never want to do because you kind of want them to do what you want them to do. And I won't tell you exactly what happened, but I'll tell you, everybody was angry. It was probably the most stressful moment I ever had in mission control. Let's just put it that way. Thank you, Steve.
Just for the record, I lost, and they played the Aggie War Hymn.
So, Paul, I was told that you were made a flight director by one of NASA's most famous flight directors. Can you tell us that story?
Well, it is a very competitive process. It is something that not every flight controller wants to be a flight director because they look at the flight director and they go, wow, that looks like a job that you're going to have to do 96 hours a week. But early on in my career, I got noticed by some people like Gene Kranz, who kind of helped shape my career and move on the way up. So my very first interview I mentioned, I was way too early in my civil service career and I wasn't going to apply. And I got a phone call saying, we want you to apply for flight director. And it came from EFK's office. And so I applied and I interviewed and it was very obvious that I was not going to get it, but they wanted me to go through the process so that the next time I would be better prepared. And it turned out that when I was getting ready I'd applied for the 1993 selection, and then I got this phone call from Gene's office saying, we need a flight director to go to Crystal City in Washington and be part of the space station redesign team, and the Russians are coming to talk about, we're going to try and put them into it, and we want you to go represent the flight director office. And I responded and I said, you know, I'm not a flight director. They said, we want you to go and represent the flight director office. Can we be any more clear? And that's kind of how I ended up in the flight director office. So it was pretty interesting. There was some career manipulation going on.
All right. Awesome. Okay. So in about 10 minutes or so, we're going to start transitioning to questions from that were texted in. But a few more questions from me. So... this is for Steve. You were a chief astronaut at one point. So let's talk a little bit about what goes into putting, you know, the science of putting crews together for missions.
Yes, Steve.
Yeah, tell us all, because we have no clue how you put crews together.
So I was chief of the astronaut office, and that means I had all of the astronauts. And when I was doing it, we had about 200 support engineers. Had a public appearances office, a bunch of administrative stuff. Then we had about 120 astronauts, international astronauts included, and Russians and everybody else. And so I would describe the chief of the astronaut office with the astronauts as basically like herding kitty cats was the way it was. So they were all smarter than me, and they all to this day believe that, you know, crew assignments were everything, right? When are you going to fly? Am I going to be on this mission? Oh, this is a really cool mission. Am I going to be on it? And they all believed there was some magical, manipulative, political kind of how we did it. And they thought it was a mystery. But it was actually, it really was, Jim. It was very straightforward. So, but we would get information from the mission ops that Paul worked for. This is the mission that's coming. This is what's going to be on the mission. You know, you have this many spacewalks. You have this kind of robotics operations. You're going to go do this, go into this orbit, whatever it was going to be. and then a date that we needed to sign them so they could start training, and which I always ignored. So I would just look at that, and then I would pick a skill and experience mix that I thought, you know, in my judgment, would accomplish the mission. Now, I will tell you, toward the end of the shuttle program, when we were building out Space Station, and I knew the shuttle was going to retire as soon as Space Station was over, one of the things I was really worried about in the office is we had a lot of older astronauts that had a lot of experience, and we had a lot of brand new astronauts that had no experience. But when the shuttle retired, I didn't know who was going to stay and who was going to walk out of the office. So my big fear was all the experienced astronauts were going to leave the office, and then we'd end up with an office with almost no experience to take us into the next decade. I didn't want that to happen. So I really focused on making sure that every new astronaut I could, and I did succeed in this, got to fly missions. So what that meant is we took a little more risk on those missions, but I think in the long run it paid off, because then we ended up, regardless of who left, we ended up with a completely experienced office. So that was one of my jobs as chief. I did a lot of, like Jim kind of alluded to that, and so did Paul, I did a lot of negotiations with Russians and the Europeans and Japanese on international crews. I had to sign the space station crews as well, and figure out who's going to fly in the international crews. When are the international astronauts flying? Is a skill mix right? Worked luck with the Russians, even negotiated things like buying Soyuz seats from the Russians and things like that, and working with the Russian Space Agency, which wasn't all that much fun. I did all of the launch and landing weather for all the shuttle missions, so I was the one making those weather calls, you know, to bring the vehicle in or you're safe to launch, working directly with the mission control and talking to them directly as I was doing that. Went over to Russia and supported the crews, Soyuz launches and landings, things like that. And then we were also working exploration programs, getting ready to go back to the moon at that time on a program called Constellation. So I was working all of that. So all in all, it was a really interesting job. I have, as you might imagine, many stories from that that I could tell that we don't have time for. But it was really a privilege, actually, to get to do that and work with a fantastic bunch of folks. I also worked directly with Paul's office all the time. And because the key to a mission being successful is a one-team approach. And when I say team, it's not just the people in the shuttle, it's the entire control team, all of the backroom team, all of the trainers, all of the folks at Kennedy Space Center that are getting in the vehicle. And if that whole team wasn't meshed, and that was really the job of the lead flight director and the commander to do that on every mission. If you didn't do that, then you weren't going to have a successful mission.
I got to mention, you know, you're flying weather, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if they did this later on in the program, but early on when I was doing a lot of ascent entry stuff, when we'd do a sim, if they wanted to really stress people before the deorbit burn, they had to come up with some way to make you no-go, right? And every once in a while, they'd come up with a call about the weather aircraft. And I remember one specific call when they said, you know, the runway just went no-go. The STA has fouled the runway. The STA is the shuttle training aircraft that he's flying as a weather aircraft. Now, this is a sim. And they come up and say, the STA has fouled the runway. And so they called it up to the commander, and this is a sim, but and the commander called down and said, where's the runway fouled? And the answer came back from the sim team, the debris field starts at 2,000 feet from the threshold and continues to the 8,000-foot point. So wow. You didn't know they were playing those kind of games.
No, I didn't know that. Yeah. But then, you know, we had a 15,000-foot runway, so you still had
you still had 7,000 feet to go.
Yeah, you could have done it.
But anybody can land in 7,000 feet.
You would think.
You'd think, yeah.
All right. What missions do you guys think don't get enough love?
Oh, I'll tell you, my favorite mission was STS-99, the Space Radar Topography Mapper. This is one that very few people heard about. We took this big radar, which had two antennas, one in the payload bay, one that stuck way out to the side. We flipped the vehicle over, and because you had two antennas, you got binocular vision, and you could map the Earth's surface topographically. We mapped every square meter of dirt from 60 degrees north to 60 degrees south on a 9-meter grid with 1-meter accuracy in 10 days. That topographic database is the basis of all topographic maps of the entire planet and will be for the next 100 years. Most people have never heard of it. We went up there, we did it. The crew just swapped tapes constantly. And it was the, it probably had more impact on the average person than any mission I ever flew.
Yeah, to add to that, because I got a related story to that, I was going to actually say the exact same mission that you just said.
Yeah.
And the reason being is, when I was in the Air Force, we were deployed down to Panama, and we had an IR sensor. I was flying an F-4 at the time. We had an IR sensor on there, and we were tasked when we were down there to look for a downed A-6 crew. And an A-6 crew had flown low level at night over the mountains of Panama. And the mountains of Panama are big and rugged. I mean, it's all jungle, but it's a surprisingly large, high mountain range. But they had lost an A-6 crew on a night low level about maybe 2 or 3 months before, and they never found them. So they sent us into the area that that they thought they might have gone down in to see with our IR sensor if we could detect the metal and find something, because the jungle grows so fast it's really hard to see anything. It's super thick jungle. So I'm out there, and in those days, this is before this mission, everything 50 clicks north or south of the canal zone was uncharted. And I was in the area where these guys allegedly went down, and I was going over a ridge at like 7,500 feet. The ridge was at 7,500 feet elevation, and I'm looking at my map, and the highest peak I see on my map is 5,000 feet. And it kind of told me that I bet I know what happened. These guys didn't have a train following radar. They had a train avoidance radar. They went in using this uncharted or these bad maps and probably hit the mountain, and we lost them. And I remember then when this mission happened, thought, this is great, because they're going to map 99% of the Earth's surface, and we're going to have accurate topographic maps, and hopefully something like what I witnessed down in Panama will never happen again.
Would not happen, yeah.
Yeah.